Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, who discusses the tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience now being practiced by thousands of opponents of the U.S. war against Iraq. Dick Clapp, a supporter of Southern Africa's liberation struggles against apartheid regimes during the 1970s and 80s, who provides historical background to better understand the current political crisis in Zimbabwe. And Angelo Anchetta of Harvard University's Civil Rights Project, who examines the case challenging affirmative action programs at the University of Michigan, now before the U.S. Supreme Court. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the world's attention is gripped by the U.S.-led attack on Iraq, other atrocities are going unnoticed. On April 3rd, nearly 1,000 villagers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo were massacred as a result of the ongoing civil war in the northeast part of the country. Investigators who went to the massacre site in Drodro in the Ituri region discovered mass graves. According to the BBC, 49 survivors managed to escape to a nearby hospital where they were treated for bullet wounds and cuts from machetes. The leader of the rebel Union of Congolese Patriots blamed the massacre on Ugandan troops that were fighting rebels near the site. The Ugandan army has denied any responsibility for the atrocity. The massacre occurred just as a peace agreement was being signed in South Africa between the Congolese government, opposition parties, militias, and rebels. On April 7th, President Kabila was sworn in to head a transitional government that will lead to new elections in 2005. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 3.3 million people have died as a result of the four-and-a-half-year conflict in the Congo, mostly caused by starvation and disease rather than by military action. Like most states, California is sinking in red ink. The state government is slashing programs for cancer research, community colleges, homeless shelters, and public transportation. Yet Governor Gray Davis, a law and order Democrat, has found the money for a pet project, a $220 million death row complex. With the backing of the Prison Guards Union, which gave $3 million to Davis's last campaign, the centrist Democrat has put funding for the new 1,000-bed death row on the front burner at the state legislature. Robert Presley, head of the State Correction Agency, says it's time to close San Quentin. As he commented to the LA Weekly, it costs a lot of money to keep running, and it sits in a very high rent district near San Francisco. Many defense lawyers welcome any improvement in prison conditions, but prisoner advocates still question the need for a 1,000-bed death row prison. As Elizabeth Samal, who runs the death row clinic at the University of California Berkeley Law School, observed, "As a taxpayer, I look around and see what is happening to our education system, to our vital social services, and I am troubled by this choice. Of all the things that could be attended to, I don't think this is at the top of the list." Every school day, lunch is served to 27 million American children, courtesy of the government's National School Lunch Program. Yet the fare is not usually very appetizing or healthy. According to Mother Jones Magazine, school kids are served bacon cheeseburgers, cheese nachos, mini corn dogs, chicken fried steak, and plenty of grease. The school lunch program, which is up for reauthorization in Congress this year, has two conflicting goals: to provide low-cost meals to students and to create a market for agribusiness, especially for the powerful beef and dairy industries. Currently, the bulk of food commodities provided to school districts consist of meat and dairy products that are loaded with saturated fat. In 2001, the USDA spent twice as much on meat and cheese as on fruit and vegetables. Critics, including many health professionals, say these practices are contributing to the epidemic of childhood obesity. As retired nutritionist Jennifer Raymond explained, basically, it's a welfare program for providers of commodities. With tight budgets, most school districts rely on government foodstuffs, even if it means compromising on nutrition. Even many USDA insiders admit privately that the lunch program is tilted toward agribusiness. As Clinton Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman observed at a beef producer trade show, "I think it's clear that the USDA and the cattlemen have a shared agenda. We've got to sell, sell, sell." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
With U.S. and British troops now battling for control of Baghdad and occupying many of Iraq's other major cities, the discussion on American media has largely turned to the issue of post-war occupation. Although it is uncertain how and when this illegal war might end, it is clear that much of the international community, particularly the Arab and Islamic world, is viewing the thousands of civilian casualties and widespread destruction of Iraq with horror and rage. Here in the U.S., tens of thousands of opponents of the Bush administration's war continue their campaign of street protests, and increasingly, since the war began, employ the tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience. In major cities and towns around the U.S., police have arrested thousands of protesters who have engaged in blockades and sit-ins at various symbolic targets, including federal buildings and busy intersections. Some protests have targeted major U.S. media outlets for their bias in covering the war, while others have aimed their demonstrations at companies like the Carlyle Group, a Republican Party-connected investment firm and military contractor. One of the most recent violent confrontations between law enforcement and anti-war protesters took place on April 7th when Oakland, California police shot wooden dowel bullets, sting balls, and beanbag rounds at several hundred picketers outside a shipping company handling U.S. military cargo. Some 20 protesters were injured and 30 arrested in what demonstration organizers described as an unprovoked attack, denying charges that rock throwing by their members set off police violence. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, who discusses the tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience now being employed by thousands of opponents of the U.S. war against Iraq.
The Iraq Pledge of Resistance is a campaign. It's not an organization, but a campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience to oppose war in Iraq. Nationally coordinated but locally organized, we now have groups in 55 cities across the country who have been organizing nonviolent CD actions to oppose the war. It is very much based on nonviolence, the nonviolence of Gandhi, the nonviolence of King, and also takes very much from the Central America Pledge of Resistance, which was a similar group in the 1980s, which was organizing nonviolent CD to oppose a U.S. invasion of Central America at the time. But as I say, we are operating in 55 cities, and literally dozens and dozens of actions have been happening across the country. Some of them that you hear about is obviously the very big ones in San Francisco and Chicago, but also actions are taking places like Athens, Ohio, and Lexington, Kentucky, and Wichita, Kansas, and places that people would consider to be the heartland and, you know, not the places you would expect to have anti-war protests, let alone acts of nonviolent civil disobedience.
Gordon, if you could summarize for us the depth and breadth of the individuals and groups that are engaging currently in nonviolent civil disobedience against the Bush administration's war in Iraq.
Sure. Well, you know, in terms of the groups that are leading it, some of them are affiliates of or offices of some of the national groups that sponsor the Iraq Pledge of Resistance. So that, for instance, American Friends Service Committee offices are very influential in the leadership in the CD actions in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Austin, Texas, and Los Angeles, California. There are other places where, for instance, it's a local Peace Action chapter or affiliate that's sort of leading the work on nonviolent CD. Sometimes it's unaffiliated peace groups, and what we're finding actually quite often is a lot of the folks now that are coming forward are sort of ad hoc groups. New people, folks who hadn't formally been organized, but who are so deeply concerned about what's going on in Iraq and so committed to opposing it in nonviolent ways that they're forming groups and stepping forward and saying, you know, we'd like to be part of this network. So right now, for instance, I'm getting calls from groups in Omaha, Nebraska, and Honolulu, Hawaii, who, you know, I have never talked with before, but they found out about our network and saying we want to be part of it. You know, in terms of the depth of it, you know, what we are seeing, a lot of the people who are doing the nonviolent CD now are folks who have never done it before. And that is, I think, very significant. It's not only, you know, some of the veterans from the Central America stuff or some, you know, Quakers who obviously have been involved in this type of activity, anti-war activity in CD for many decades in cases, but folks who have never done this before, and whether they are students or housekeepers or other professionals, professionals, or as in the case recently out in San Francisco, a former Marine commander and head of the Pacific Stock Exchange, former president of the Pacific Stock Exchange, did civil disobedience out in San Francisco. A lot of vets right now, U.S. veterans, the military forces, are involved in civil disobedience. So I think that demonstrates the the breadth of the movement, and the depth of it is the fact that already there are over, I think it's something like over 6,000 people nationwide who have been arrested in acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, and folks continue to step forward. Both people have already done it who are wanting to, volunteering to do it again, and folks who have, seen the example set by their colleagues and are now stepping forward to do it. It is going on. It wasn't just a one-week or a two-week thing that's now gone away. This type of action is going on in cities all across the country. So this is going on, and it's not something that we're going to see go away, simply because the war has gone on longer than anyone expected.
Gordon Clark, why engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, and what does sitting down in the middle of the street or blocking a doorway, what does that accomplish?
Well, I think we engage in nonviolent civil disobedience for a couple of reasons. One of them is to raise the level of our protest to the highest possible level. For a lot of people, they engage in this because they've done everything else they can. They've used all their words. They've spoken to their legislators. They've written. They've talked to people. And all of this has been ignored. So now that they are taking the next step and literally putting their body on the line or crossing the line and willing to sacrifice some small part of their liberty or freedom to try and prevent or stop this war now at the earliest possible moment. So I think that's a big part of it, to raise our protest to the highest possible level for both personal reasons as well as to attract attention to the issue through the media, and obviously nonviolent civil disobedience are actions which are or can be very attractive to the media, and I would argue can in fact be attractive to the mainstream public when they see them through the media, and to encourage the practice of nonviolent resistance. You know, a lot of people, unfortunately, in the contemporary peace movement don't realize there's a big difference between simply being peaceful and following nonviolent resistance. Obviously, we always want people to be peaceful. We're not looking for violent incidents. We're not looking for just random destruction of property or anything like that. But nonviolent resistance is a specific theory of resistance to war that's based on what Gandhi taught, that's based on what Martin Luther King taught, and it's based on love and compassion, and specifically the willingness of people to take on personal risk and to endure personal suffering in an attempt to prevent the suffering of other people. We are really looking to promote the practice of nonviolent resistance, as I would argue, ultimately the only thing that is going to be able to stop a government which is quite openly committed to global military hegemony. Empire, if you will. As A.J. Mustey said, a very famous nonviolent activist, only nonviolence can apply therapy to violence. So I think that that's, over the longer term, what we're trying to do with these actions.
That was Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance. The group can be contacted by calling area code 301-608-2450 or visit their website at www.peacepledge.org. In parliamentary elections last weekend in March, Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, continued to make gains. This was against a backdrop of increasing violence and repression from the government of President Robert Mugabe and his Zimbabwe African National Union and Patriotic Front, or ZANU-PF, which has ruled the country since independence in 1980. Opposition groups called a strike in mid-March that crippled the nation's economy for 2 days. The head of the Movement for Democratic Change, Morgan Tsvangirai, issued a list of 15 demands to the government, which included restoring freedom of the press, the disbanding of government militias, and the release of political prisoners. The March 31st deadline set for meeting these demands was ignored by Mugabe and his government. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dick Clapp, a longtime Southern Africa Solidarity activist who struggled against apartheid regimes there during the 1970s and 80s. He provides historical background to better understand the current political crisis in Zimbabwe, including the Lancaster House Agreements of 1980, which provided the framework for the country's transition from the British colony of southern Rhodesia to an independent African nation.
Of the two organizations that represented the vast majority of the African people in Zimbabwe, ZANU was the one that really carried on the guerrilla struggle, the armed struggle, to the point where the old regime under Ian Smith had to relent, and the Lancaster House process began. So Mugabe in particular and ZANU as an organization were the leadership of the new government when it took power in 1980.
Who does he represent now, would you say?
Well, you know, there are ex-combatants in ZANU, ex-guerrillas that are some of them, you know, still loyal to Mugabe. This was a big portion of the population, I think, was either in the guerrilla struggle or in some way connected to the guerrilla struggle. So some of the ex-combatants themselves are still represented by Mugabe. And then there's the civil service and, you know, a large number of government employees that, to some extent, owe their jobs to the government and therefore to Mugabe.
The biggest issue, at least for people who don't know much about Zimbabwe, probably know, if they know anything, that there's been a big struggle over land reform and providing land to the landless black Africans who don't have any, and that most of the good farmland and the most productive farmland has been, up until recently, been controlled by white farmers. And Mugabe has been, as I understand it, supporting the expulsion of the farmers to provide those good lands to the black African majority. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, I think that was part of, in some ways, there was this historic compromise in the Lancaster House Agreement to allow white property owners to continue to not have their land expropriated by the new government. There were even large tracts of land that were fallow, that were not being used for agriculture, but which were owned by white farmers. And yet this was a country that had a vast majority of mostly landless African peasants that needed a place to grow food and earn their living. So the fact that there was so much land left after the Lancaster House agreements in the hands of whites was a sore point, was a point of contention for years. And so I think Mugabe was able to draw on that discontent and draw on the desires, the legitimate desires, in my view, for land for homeless and otherwise penniless peasants to be able to use the land. And so when there was this effort to seize it by either government troops or ex-combatants that were themselves sort of vigilante groups, Mugabe in some ways in the last 5 or 10 years encouraged that, even though it was a violation of the agreements that had been made at independence.
So are we just getting one side of the story when, the way it's presented is, you know, he's promoting giving landless black peasants basically what they're due, but that it's being done in a way that has really disappointed and embittered a lot of people who originally supported ZANU and supported Mugabe. Shortly after independence, Zimbabwe was touted as, you know, a model new nation, that things seemed to be going very well. They had a lot of resources and things seemed to be looking up, and that over the last few years, or last several years, I guess, things have not been looking up. They've been looking pretty down. And I think that corruption is probably a big part of that. But would you say that at this point he represents the majority of even black Zimbabweans?
Well, that's not my impression at the current time, that there has been a major opposition, political opposition to him, including, in the last election, a sort of serious challenge by a labor leader. As I think you implied, it had turned into such a corrupt political machine that was squelching opposition that there was really a grassroots movement against Mugabe and his party. And that's what's led to this current standoff. And I think now the land seizures that are happening now are more of the kind of demagogic type and or opportunistic type, that they're not so much pushing for the legitimate aspirations of peasants as much as building or solidifying political support for Mugabe, and in fact playing the race card, actually.
That was Dick Clapp, a Boston-based solidarity activist who supported the liberation struggle in what is now Zimbabwe. For more information, contact Africa Action by calling area code 202-546-7961 or visit the group's website at www.africapolicy.org.
As the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the latest challenge to affirmative action, an estimated 50,000 supporters of the program, many of them students from across the U.S., rallied in March just steps away from where justices and lawyers gathered to debate the highly charged issue. Opponents of affirmative action, backed by the Bush administration, launched this legal challenge against the University of Michigan's undergraduate and law school admissions program. This is the first significant challenge to affirmative action since the High Court's controversial Bakke decision 25 years ago. The University of Michigan defended its admissions policy of awarding extra points to African American, Native American, and Latino student applicants on the basis of the school's effort to encourage diversity in its academic environment. But the Bush administration's Solicitor General, Theodore Olson, argued that the university's programs are unconstitutional because the school hadn't pursued race-neutral alternative methods to achieve diversity. Many observers noted that questions from the justices during the hearing indicated that the Supreme Court would likely uphold the constitutionality of most elements of affirmative action. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Angelo Anchetta, director of legal and policy advocacy programs at Harvard University's Civil Rights Project, who assesses the Supreme Court case challenging affirmative action programs and the state of race relations in America.
Well, there's two basic lines of argument. One is that the policies are unconstitutional and that the promotion of diversity, which is the interest that the university has put out as its interest in considering race, isn't basically a compelling enough interest to justify the use of race. And on the other side, you have the university itself arguing that promoting diversity is compelling and that the means used to advance that interest, basically looking at race through an admissions process, either under a point system, which is what they use at the undergraduate level, or through a individualized review system, which is what they use at the law school, that both of these systems are basically constitutional and designed to promote their interest in diversity.
Give us your arguments in favor of affirmative action. Why do you feel affirmative action programs are necessary to preserve in the United States in 2003? Many critics say, you know, race-based hiring and admissions process in our universities is a thing of the past. Why do you think it isn't?
Well, I think it depends on what you're trying to advance. And clearly in the higher education setting, as well as in much of the employment sector, you're looking at the promotion of diversity within an institution, whether it's in a student body or in the workplace or among your managers. Clearly there are important interests in trying to promote the integration and diversity within an institution that reflects the character of the United States. That was, we're a racially and ethnically diverse society, and we want our institutions, particularly our institutions that produce leaders, and institutions that, you know, obviously wield a considerable amount of power to be reflective of our nation as a whole. So I think it's important for that purpose. But, I mean, there are plenty of other good reasons why race could be considered, and I think it's important to realize that when the courts are looking at these kinds of programs, that there are different kinds of interests that the courts are willing to uphold as constitutional. Diversity is one interest. Trying to remedy past discrimination, particularly by an institution itself, is also an important enough reason to justify the use of race.
Angelo Anchetta, there are some university systems, I believe California and Texas, that have been forced by the courts to remove affirmative action programs from their admission policies. How has that affected the makeup of their student body? And maybe you could talk about what you think would happen nationwide if the Supreme Court does abolish affirmative action across the country.
What you've seen in states like Texas, which is under a court ruling that basically said you can't use race in admissions, and then also in California, which has an even broader ban on the use of racial preferences, is a steep decline in the number of minority students who have been admitted at the undergraduate, graduate, and professional school level. So there's been a really quite an extraordinary impact on the number of minority students that are going into the most elite institutions in those states. And I think what we're likely to see is if we have similar kinds of policies that essentially eliminate the use of race in admissions, that we're going to see drops in enrollment as well nationwide. And I think that's troubling, I think, to think that we couldn't use race even as a consideration in admissions, and I think the consequences are going to be dire.
Dire in what way? Tell us what you think the end result is. Beyond the numbers going down, what is the net effect down the line?
Well, I think we have to remember that diversity and within the an institution, a higher education institution, isn't simply designed to benefit minority students. That, in fact, the positive benefits of having a diverse student body are really beneficial to all students, and that the interaction, the breaking down of stereotypes, the elimination of tokens within universities is really a universal benefit. And when we consider that enrollment numbers could drop significantly, that I think means a tremendous amount in terms of how our future leaders are going to be trained. Not only are we going to see fewer minority students being prepared for leadership positions, we're also going to see non-minority students who have less exposure, have less understanding of minorities, and unfortunately, we may see more stereotyping and more discrimination occurring.
There was something called the Southern Strategy employed by Richard Nixon and probably many other politicians before and since, and that is a conscious effort by politicians to divide black from white to win elections, with majority white congressional districts. Do you see this effort to abolish affirmative action as sort of being part and parcel of a conscious political strategy to win elections and maintain majorities in the House and Senate and gain the White House?
Well, I think that's a partial strategy, because I think the tension that the Bush administration is feeling is between its more conservative elements, and I think that's clear when you look at its basic position in terms of affirmative action. But it's also trying to, I think, appeal to minority voters as much as it can. And I think that's why you come up with these inconsistent positions in terms of affirmative action, where you say that we do want campus diversity, we do want to see racial minorities gaining access to our elite institutions, and yet the policy that the Bush administration is willing to adopt is one that's race neutral and, in essence, tries to guarantee diversity by random chance more than anything else, not really looking at how essential it is to consider race in order to have racial diversity on campus.
That was Angelo Anchetta, Director of Legal and Policy Advocacy Programs at Harvard University's Civil Rights Project. Contact the project at area code 617-496-6367 or visit the website at www.civilrightsproject.harvard.edu. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.